Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 8th, 2003. Today's session is entitled Challenges Facing Humanitarian Relief, Session 5 in the second week of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality, Some New Visions for the Future of God's Earth and God's People, presented by Jim Bowman, number BOJ 2003-10. Let's listen in.
A friend of mine said, you know, you aren't recognizing the people that live up the upper levels that when they raise their hands. So if you have a question and you aren't getting my attention, you may have to just yell out, because in the darkness you just sort of fade out. I don't want to ignore you. Feel free to interrupt me. We can start the recording. I'm giving that instruction to the recorder in case you're not familiar with this. Seems strange thing to do. But anyway, start the recording. My name is Jim Bowman, and I'm Director of the Office of Public Policy for Lutheran World Relief in Washington, D.C. How many of you here attended the morning session on Iraq with Jonathan Frerichs this week? He did an evening session, and then he did a morning session. You did the morning session, just one of you. Okay. Well, then I guess I wouldn't have had to change my preparation, because I went to that morning session, and basically it was one of those impromptu things prompted by questions. And what I was going to do today was sort of what he already did. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to do something different. So
To reinforce what he said, you will hit me.
I will touch on some of those things, but I won't. What I'd like to do this morning is give a little bit of a biblical background and a theological background and a little bit of a historical background of humanitarian aid as we, as a Lutheran agency, see it. We meaning Lutheran World Relief. And I'll try to keep it fairly simple, not too ambitious. Hopefully there's still time for discussion when we get through, or even along the way. So don't hesitate to interrupt me. And I'm going to begin by retelling the Good Samaritan story that you're so familiar with that I'm sure we don't need to read it again, but we're going to put it in a little bit of different framework, and it's based on a retelling of that story by a theologian who just died here a number of years ago. He was just a wonderful man, Robert McAfee Brown. And he tells the story something like this. A salesman was traveling in his company car on the way to Jericho early in the morning for his day's work, and he comes across this man lying on the road, bleeding. He stops, realizes that if he doesn't do something, the man will probably die, so he binds up his wounds temporarily, puts him in his car, drives into Jericho, finds the nearest hospital, makes sure that the man is going to be treated, leaves his credit card, and says, "I'll check back with you the next day, he returns home that night. The next day, he comes down that road. Let me just stop at this point and ask the question. It was obvious, it seems to me, what should be done in this situation. We'll eliminate those people who pass by on the other side in the real story, because that doesn't serve our purposes here. But, you know, I would assume that all of you here would do the same thing. You may do it a little differently, but hopefully as you're driving down the road, you see someone in serious trouble, you would stop and respond. We call the churches, you sort of call this response the response of compassion to those people who are hurting and need emergency assistance. But this particular salesman comes to Jericho the next day, and he sees another guy lying there in the road. Same thing, he's bleeding. He said he was beaten up by robbers, and just like the first person. And the salesman does the same thing. He's a good Lutheran Christian, so he takes him into town, gives the hospital his credit card, and goes about his business, and then it goes home. Doesn't sell as much that day because it takes a little bit longer. The third day and the fourth day, the same thing happens. His wife starts to get a little bit irritated with him. The resources aren't so much as they were before to provide for his own family. And she begins to ask a different kind of question. And what would that question be?
Why are all these guys getting beaten up every day?
What?
Why are people
getting beaten up all the day? That's an important question. And then a second question could be,
why are you stopping?
What?
Why are you stopping?
Right. Well, another question could be, how can we make this road safer for these people so I don't have to stop? I mean, that's a, you know, why are they doing this? How can we make the road safer? So you begin to ask a different kind of question. It's not necessarily, it's a different type of compassion in terms of response. It isn't just simply being satisfied to bind up the wounds, which is the most immediate response. But when you begin to, let's follow that through just for the purposes of playing along with this story, how would you make the road safer if you lived in this community near Jericho and you had to travel there every day and obviously people were getting beat up? How would you make the road safer for travel?
Station some guards or soldiers along the way.
That's right. Let's hire some more highway patrolmen to travel up and down, or soldiers or people who can protect.
Put some lights up.
Put some lights
probably
up.
Probably happening at night.
They're happening at night, or pass laws that you can't travel at night, or you know if you can't afford the lights, or a lot of these solutions that you've talked about cost money, right? They cost money, and at least in our world that we're familiar with, where's that money going to come from?
Decreased taxes.
It's going to have to come from the public, unless you find a generous benefactor to do that. So it's usually we're talking about a community kind of response. Well, let's say that you are able to make the road safer, people aren't getting beat up. What happens? The robbers still have to make a living too, don't they? And they move to suburban Jericho and start breaking into homes in suburban Jericho. So you realize at that point that there's another question that has to be dealt with.
Why are they robbing people?
Why are they robbing people? And can't we rehabilitate these people and find other livelihoods for them that they can, you know, earn some other kind of a living? So that's what Robert McAfee does when he talks about the relationship between compassion and advocacy and a community response to injustice. And I think it's a good way of sort of getting us started. Lutheran World Relief's humanitarian and relief work is rooted in what I see our basic understanding, now we're getting into the theology, away from the story, our basic understanding of who God is, who we are, and answering the question, what does God desire for us and for all of creation? Those are sort of basic theological questions. It seems to me that should shape our daily lives, and it should certainly shape whatever our humanitarian work would be. In biblical language, this is simply expressed, I would probably the most simply and easily, is God is love, and we are to love God and our neighbors as ourselves. It's an oversimplified response. But if we were to explore that a little more deeply, what does it mean when we say that God is love? The biblical language is language that really touches our daily lives and our daily needs. God is the one, at least in the Old Testament, the kind of creed that they recited over and over again. God is the one who rescued us from oppression when we were slaves in Egypt. That's who God is. child asked, "Who's God?" Well, God is the one who's rescued us from Egypt. God is the one who executes justice on behalf of the oppressed and who gives food to the hungry. And moving very quickly into the New Testament, God is the one who in Jesus was revealed in Jesus' own words, going back to those Old Testament passages when Jesus describes his mission in those words that we heard that are recited every Wednesday night here in Holden Village, that passage from Isaiah. My mission is to bring good news to the poor, release to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Well, having answered the question of God very, very simply and probably inadequately, we ask the question then, who are we? And again, the answer, the simple answer is, we are the people of God, created in God's image. And this is maybe the little different wrinkle. We are created to do what God does, to love and care for God's creation. Central to the message of the Hebrew prophets and central to the message of the ministry of Jesus is reaching out to those who are impoverished, deprived of human dignity, and victimized by injustice. As people of faith, this is what we are also called to do. Well, how do we do this? How do we do God's work? I think it's important to understand also at this point how the scriptures view the biblical understanding of poverty and injustice comes about. It is not, the Bible does not, in most cases, portray poverty as a result of one of the, I erased it here from this morning, one of those seven deadly sins, which is sloth. Understood as, of course, Brian didn't define it this way, but our common understanding of sloth is laziness. There may be examples of poverty that are due to laziness, but the biblical passages seems to indicate a couple of things. First of all, that people are poor because of circumstances that have afflicted them. That's one understanding of poverty and injustice. So, when we're looking at the three classifications of people who are poor and afflicted in the Old Testament, what are we talking about? Who are we talking about in the Old Testament? We're talking about
widows.
What?
Orphans
and
elderly.
No. They may be elderly.
Crippled. Crippled people or
No. When I say it, you're all gonna remember it.
Yeah, well, come on.
The stranger in your midst.
Yeah, the sojourner.
The sojourners, aliens, all those words are used to describe those. And all three categories are usually people from a variety, we would say refugees today, people who are left behind, people who have had to be displaced or something for one reason or another. So so one way of looking at poverty and injustice, biblically at least, is that many of the people who are poor, at least these categories of people, are poor because of circumstances that have affected them. But there's also another factor, and I'll just especially among the Hebrew prophets, there's the view that poverty is also the result of greed and unjust practices, not because of circumstances of people, but because of people who are greedy because of what they do. The expression Amos uses, they trample on the poor, and I'll read a familiar couple verses from Amos. This is speaking of the unjust and the wealthy. Therefore, because you trample on the poor and take from them levies of grain, You have built houses of hewn stone, but you shall not live in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink their wine. For I know how many are your transgressions, and how great are your sins. You who afflict the righteous, you who take a bribe and push aside the needy in the gate. That's another view of why there is poverty and injustice, because of what people do to people. The psalmist in another passage says, the wicked draw the sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and the needy. Isaiah, another passage, is angry and talks about those who write. This is what I really like, because when I talk, this is a good proof text for me when I talk about trade rules. Listen how current this is. Prophet rails against those who write oppressive statutes to turn aside the needy from justice. The moral problem in this case, problem of poverty, is that people have followed greed rather than God, and as a result, the poor lose, and the productive, they lose their basic productive resources, in most cases in the world it's their land, and fall into continuing cycles of indebtedness. The economic statement of the ELC, have any of you read that, the sufficient sustainable livelihood for all? It's a wonderful social statement about economic justice, but the comment there is that poverty is a problem of the whole human community, not only of those who are poor and vulnerable. A philosopher has said it a different way. When I'm hungry, it's a material, you probably heard this, when I'm hungry, it's a material problem. When my neighbor is hungry, it's a spiritual problem. I think that's a pretty powerful way of saying it. When I'm hungry, I mean, my biggest need is the food that I need. But if my neighbor is hungry, it's a spiritual problem, because it indicates probably some kind of inequity. Some resources aren't being shared for one reason or another. Institutional structures were in place in the ancient Near East society, just as they are today. Not the same structures, but there was an attempt to make sure that everyone's need was provided for. They didn't have social security, but some of the laws that I'm sure you're all familiar with included leaving produce in the fields for the poor to gather, the widows, again. There was a period of periodic cancellation of debts, and a jubilee year when property was redistributed or restored to those who had lost it so that they might again have a means of livelihood.
Did that ever really happen?
There's some indication that what that was supposed to happen was every 50th year was the jubilee. After 49 years, then the 50th year was supposed to be the jubilee. The evidence is that there's no evidence that it really did happen. So we can't really say that it was a policy that worked. It was certainly in writing as something that. But the seventh year, where there was supposed to be a partial restoration, or especially those things dealing with letting land lie fallow and rest, you know, those were things that were probably followed, just in terms as far as good farming practices.
But the actual, I've not ever read where there was actual any evidence of, you know,
no
proactive redistribution.
No, these were just. Sort of the ideal, but we don't know. I think my own personal feeling, it would have been, it's incredibly idealistic, and it would be extremely difficult to make happen.
To administer.
Yes. How would you do that? After 50 years, how would you determine who was the original owner anyway? Because we know that the Israelites displaced the people in the lands that they occupied. So, I mean, it is a vision of justice that at least talks about the right of people to have a means of livelihood. Whether it happened or not, we don't We don't know.
But to hold that up as an ideal, kind of lets us off the hook just as it did them.
Well,
I mean, it was never the 50th year because it was always, well, this is the 7th one, not not the 8th one.
That's
therefore,
right.
Therefore, it's not timely.
That's right. Well, I'm gonna skip over sort of the Lutheran theology part of this because I, you all are good Lutherans. You know why? You know what Luther says about this. So we don't. There are other people here that talk about Luther all the time. So we'll just go on. What I'd like to do is have you think for a few moments about some of the examples from Scripture of people who plead the case of the voiceless or the vulnerable or the powerless before courts of power. That's how we usually define advocacy. Advocacy is a word that is kind of a legal word. Advocate is a synonym for attorney or attorney or lawyer. And can you think of some examples from scriptures of people who pleaded the case of vulnerable people in the presence of power and authority? You can just all, I'm sure, just there are lots of stories here. That's right. Abraham, boy, I mean, how high can you go in terms of the courts of power? Abraham pleading to God to spare Sodom and Gomorrah. That's one example.
Moses.
Moses, right. Moses going before the courts of Pharaoh. And then later on in the wilderness, Moses interceding to God on behalf of the people, and then also trying to also communicate God's will to the people too, in sort of both ways. But
Lot,
yes, another story. You were going to say something?
I said Jesus.
And Jesus.
Oh, sure. The story of the stoning and countless others.
That's right. One of the more courageous stories, I think, is the story of the prophet Nathan. Because he took a pretty big risk when he confronted David for the sin that he had committed. It's another good example. It's interesting that the one time, or the couple times, that the word advocate, the Greek word for advocate is paraclete. And that word is used how? It's used in the New Testament.
The Holy Spirit.
The Holy Spirit is referred to as the paraclete, who intercedes on our behalf, who speaks for us. So there are lots of ideas lots of stories about this. Proverbs, probably the passage in Proverbs comes the closest, and it's talk about advocacy is speaking out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and the needy. Now, I would like to just sort of talk about more recent history now and talk about how this biblical or theological framework has shaped the work. And I could talk about it, the work of the church, but I want to be more specific, by giving examples of Lutheran World Relief because of the topic that's been kind of assigned to us. Over the last 50 years, we've talked about our mission. Lutheran World Relief sort of has a mission statement, and the statement has been to share God's love and healing through the emergency relief and development programs that we've conducted over 50 years around the world in about 50 countries now. Even from those earliest years, it wasn't just simply compassion, responding to binding up the wounds, but it also included a much broader idea, and it's grown over the years, of what I call development work and advocacy work. As you know, in the 1940s, in the mid-1940s, Lutheran World Relief was one of the first humanitarian agencies to urge the U.S. government to allow the provision of humanitarian aid into the American-controlled sector of Germany. LWR spoke about the suffering that its staff saw firsthand and argued, and this is an important argument that sort of goes into what becomes the Geneva Convention, and that is their argument was that LWR, Lutheran World Relief, should have the right to provide, and people should have the right to receive, both the right to provide and people the right to receive, humanitarian aid, regardless of the hostilities between the nations. There wasn't, those of you who were living at that, I was living, but I don't remember that time very well, but those of you who were old enough to remember that time, perhaps could sympathize with the lack of, for good reasons, why people in America wouldn't want to go over there and assist the people who had been killing their, mostly their young men. So it was a real challenge to try to get that attitude changed. And yet, that happened, and as a result of other humanitarian, we weren't the only ones doing this, but we were very much at the front and center of this effort to provide humanitarian aid, and it was not without some difficulty persuading the U.S. government to allow this to happen, to persuade ships to and to make arrangements for the ships to carry those supplies as well. And this is the principle then that even at that early time becomes embodied in the Geneva Convention, which was written in 1948. And that is that the aid should be provided based on need and not national origin, religion, or political affiliation.
Well, the Marshall Plan followed those principles. It was one of the unique programs in history.
Absolutely, yeah. The Marshall Plan embodied that. I mean, that's what was so incredible, and that's, I think, why it worked as well as it did, because it embodied these principles. The principles, let me just read that section of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, because it's more than just, we sometimes when we think about humanitarian aid, we think primarily of food, perhaps, and shelter and clothing. Those would be probably the three items. But listen to what this says. It really has amazing application to even our situations today. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself. It's all male. I won't change that. I mean, it's, you know, maybe. And well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. That's a pretty broad kind of statement, isn't it? When we examine each one of those words, it includes some of the Old Testament categories, widowhood, but it includes some of the things you thought were there, the old age that was mentioned, but basically the lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control.
What was the source of that?
Well, that was the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was signed by all the members that formed the United Nations at that time, and that all succeeding members sign on to when they become members of the United Nations.
So that was,
and that's just, excuse me,
what? When was it written?
1948. And of course, it's a much, this is not the whole declaration. I mean, there are, as any declaration is, and as any legal document is, it's a long, extended thing. There are many pages to it. This is one chapter. How many are there? There are 15 pages from one chapter in a in a publication on the human right to adequate food, and it deals just with that. This deals with just the right to food, using that declaration as some explanation of it. So anyway, those are what's contained in the Declaration of Rights, and it's something that and actually that Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the what has been emphasized in that in the first say 40 or 50 years have been the civil and political rights. As when it comes to looking at violations, and it tends to be more individualistic. In other words, if my civil rights have been violated or my political rights have been violated, then there's some need to make compensation. But in towards the end of the last century, and even now, you will find a growing emphasis on what's called the economic and social rights embedded in this, that you heard me read, embedded in this Declaration of Human Rights. And it's that, those economic and human rights that are now being used by a lot of humanitarian and relief agencies to help them in where they put their effort and what they're trying to do. It's not just simply, and it emphasizes the community or the communal aspects of human rights rather than just my own individual rights. It's more my rights as a member of a community, because in many cases, the community is critical to these rights. It's possible, for example, for the sake of discussion, let me ask this question. Can the human right to adequate food be fulfilled by an authoritarian regime? Just for the sake of discussion. Let's assume that we have a right to adequate food. Could that be fulfilled by an authoritarian regime?
Sure.
Of course it could. I mean, an extreme example that we could give, and it came up, I think, actually in this last war that we had, is that you could serve pork to a Muslim prisoner, someone in prison, right? He would have adequate nutrition. He would have food, right? His right to adequate food could be fulfilled in this. I'm obviously picking out a real extreme example here. But it's for the purpose of sort of illustrating that when we're talking about these rights, we're talking more than just food for the body. We're talking about life in a community and life that involves more than just adequate food in terms of nutrition. Let me just give you sort of the framework for how we have laid out our relief and development work based on this kind of approach, a much broader approach of economic and social rights. And this is the statement. LWR's advocacy work, like its relief and development work, is based on a rights-based approach that is grounded in our faith and in international law, and that puts people first and promotes human-centered development, recognizes the inherent dignity of every human being without distinction, recognizes and promotes equality between men and women, promotes equal opportunities and choices so that everyone can develop their own unique potential and have a chance to contribute to development and social progress, promotes national and international systems based on economic equity and equity in the access to public resources and social justice, and finally, promotes mutual respect between peoples as a basis for peace, justice, and conflict resolution and sustainable development. Those are all sort of, I mean, these kind of statements are always so, you know,
broad.
They're very broad. I think probably a more a helpful thing, and we mentioned this the other day, is when we talk about the ethical framework of what we do, and I find this to be a little more helpful. And let me just list them and then talk just a little bit about this. And I think it's helpful when we not just simply think about humanitarian relief, but when we think about other things as well. This is a principle. The principle of participation. When decisions are being made about the use of the Earth's resources, many people and many communities, especially in developing countries, but also in our country, lack the power to fully participate in those decisions that are being made. So the principle of participation says that all people, especially in this community, who are being affected by those decisions, they have the right to be heard and represented in the decisions that are being made. Does that seem like a no-brainer? I mean, don't you think that should be the case? That the people who are being affected by those decisions, if they're going to come in, assuming there were people living here at the time that the copper was discovered, and I don't know the history of that, but I would assume that the people living in this community should be consulted about that, not just simply, you know, some mining company on the East Coast, and you know the history more than I do probably, but I mean, I'm just giving that as an example. Yeah.
Trying to think, just, you know, the outline of the board was that we were talking about how we interact aid in times of war. For instance, if Liberia is going to be coming up real soon. Now, I imagine the Lutheran World Relief has kind of made the plans for that, but like, how would you enact participation when you're going to go in with the American forces to take care of a country that's had civil war for 14 years and hasn't been able to plant a crop?
Yeah. That's a very difficult situation, and we could probably spend all this time alone talking about humanitarian relief in situations of war or at post-war conflict, because many times the community has been destroyed. There is no community. People are just sort of living hand to mouth. But I think that, I mean, that's the struggle that we're facing right now in terms of Iraq, if you want to go back to another situation. What is the community? Who in the community is to be involved in to participate? I think, when you have such a diverse, so many political parties, so many extremes in terms of religious groups, how do all of those groups participate? Seems to me the principle is still important. In Liberia, I mean, there are people that are there. I think that people, whatever the aid is, need to be consulted. And whether you've got a plan to provide seed and tools. I mean, this is what happened in Liberia. This shows how extreme it is. In the intervening war years, when people were involved, Lutheran World Relief was involved, Lutheran World Federation, actually, we gave some money to them to be involved in Liberia, and they had a packet of seeds and some small tools to provide Liberians to just plant. They didn't have seeds. And because of the uncertainty of the war, some of the people decided to eat the seeds. That was the only food they had. So perhaps if there had been some discussion ahead of time, what do you really need here? They may have needed another solution rather than just being handed. I'm not saying that that was a wrong decision. I mean, that was, people who are desperate do desperate things, but that's just I'm just laying that out as a principle, but it's not so easy. And we can come back to some of these as well. Okay. Solidarity. Another principle. And this goes back to this sort of theological basis or biblical understanding. As part of God's creation, we are interdependent on each other. And this principle calls us, it seems to me, to act when we, whatever actions we take, but I'm thinking primarily now of humanitarian work, to act on behalf of all creation, standing with victims of natural disasters, violence, war, racial, gender, or economic discrimination. Any of those categories. We are not standing outside of that community. We are part of all of creation. We aren't just sort of safe. I think of our situation here in Holden Village, a pretty isolated place to be, and you're sort of safe. There have been attempts to sort of bring people into utopian communities where they can sort of take care of each other, but then sort of forget about the plight of the rest of the world. So solidarity is important.
Jim, I'm thinking of the catfish farm.
Yes.
From farming, and how do you be in solidarity from a global perspective? You were saying with all of the victims, with all of the people, how do you weigh 1.3 million Vietnamese catfish farmers against 13,000 American catfish farmers, and be in solidarity?
Well, I think that, my feeling about that situation there's not much that I can do about one point. I can advocate on their behalf in terms of saying that tariffs should not be applied to those imported catfish fillets because we need to support the people in Vietnam. I can do that, but I can't do much about, I don't have the power or the ability to make a difference there in that situation. I can do some advocacy work here. But I think that speaking as a Lutheran community or as a Christian community in this country, there are some things that could be done to provide some assistance for the people in this, the smaller number of people in this country. And that's where we need to be more creative, more aggressive, more imaginative. But I think we can't forget. We can't just dismiss, 1.2 million Vietnamese who are trying to make a living growing catfish, as hard as it might be. So I think we need to.
If we're talking about a country like Liberia, mm-hmm. and we're talking about participation and solidarity, it's something is very difficult in a country like that where you have all of these tribes. I have lived in Liberia for 4 years, mm-hmm. and I know if you get somebody from every tribe, they still don't get along with mm-hmm. each other. Mm-hmm. I belong to this tribe, you're afraid of me because of the power I have and the tribe I belong to. Mm-hmm. For instance, a refugee whom I knew who came over here from Liberia, she wanted nothing to do with any other Liberians lest it be somebody, this was just after the war, there is such a thing, lest it be somebody from the wrong tribe who would do something to her even over here. Mm-hmm. You have to really be there to understand this thing.
Well, in situations of war, when people are killing each other, those are very, it's difficult. It seems to me that's but just because that's the reality or that's the difficulty, I think people of faith have much different vision of how, that's part of the gospel, isn't it? That breaks down these kinds of barriers and breaks through? Isn't that what the, isn't that what, I mean, I realize I'm dealing here with the ideal, but if you don't have a ethical framework out of which you're, if you're just always going to be just very, I mean, I know we have to be pragmatic, but if we don't have this vision of what God wants for creation, we will constantly, I mean, it is the challenge. It's the challenge that we're talking about.
Yeah, I agree with you. But I think the people who work with them have to be aware of this. Mm-hmm. You know, we Americans know what to do. But it isn't easy.
No, it's...
I remember when there were Americans came over. This was peacetime. And they were talking to this man who was really working with agriculture. And they wanted to get co-ops started. Mm-hmm. All this good advice. And I happened to be on campus at that time. They invited me to the lunch, too. And see, at that point, I was a Liberian. I wasn't one of these Americans. They said, you know, each farmer just paid $10. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, I can't afford to pay $10. So I said, well, if they just pay $1. And so they politely listened. And after they went, they said to me, you know what would happen? Yes. Whoever was a treasurer would eat the money. I mean, you have to know about these things in order to go in and work on those things.
Back here.
Would some way of establishing a feeling of trust between various groups where you yourself would be trusted not to use the money for, I don't know how that would be done in different settings, but that's sort of what it boils down to. You can't really trust your neighbor, and usually when you can't trust your neighbor, you're not really very trustworthy yourself.
One of the challenges that we're facing, I mean, not just simply at a local individual level on who's holding the money, but at the highest level in terms of decisions that are made at governmental levels and intergovernmental levels, is the lack of transparency in all of these things. I mean, if people don't know where the money is and where it's going, that's, it seems to me, another violation of whatever, you know, principle. There needs to be openness. Well, we can come back to that. I want to get through these others here. Here's another one. Sufficiency, the principle of sufficiency that I wrote down means that no person or group has absolute claim to the earth and its products. No person or group has absolute claim to the earth and its products. Sufficiency calls us, and this is where we get into it, calls us to be good stewards, affirming the norm that no one has, now this is the difference, no one, and this is where you may disagree with me, no one has the right to live in excess or excessively consume Earth's resources at the expense of the poor. How do you feel about that statement?
I think you need to delete that.
Oil. Yeah, right.
I think that's it's true, ideally.
True, ideally, but again, as we all know, how difficult. I mean, if we really, I mean, these are principles, I think, that are important to be discussed in a society, because if we don't agree to those, I mean, if we do agree to these principles, then it seems to me that we ought to be thinking about how do we shape specific policies that would fit with these principles? How would we shape it?
What I'm struck with is that you know, we value personal integrity.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in many parts of the world, and I think you were alluding to this, ma'am, I mean, the value is, and the expectation is, if you have it, you run with it. You take it and run with it. I mean, that's the cultural expectation.
I think what the expectation in the library is that if you're working for the church and you're holding money for the church, your greater moral responsibility is to your family or to the people that call you brother and sister, all your cousins and stuff around the village. So if those cousins in the village have a need, they're hungry, your responsibility is more toward them than toward the church. It's not that they don't have integrity. It's just where their integrity is focused. And I mean, you really can't. I mean, it's hard to deny that. You just have to set up some guidelines for it. But that's the way we experience it in libraries. That they had brothers and sisters that were hungry, and rather than save that money in a pot for the church's offering, they spend it on their brothers and sisters.
But my point is that that's a cultural expectation in that culture, and everybody in that culture knows about it. So to keep it for this communal farm was just foreign. I mean, it was just kind of, you don't think that way. So then we go to sufficiency, and we're North Americans, and we go, huh? Yeah, no, that's not for us. The cultural expectation is spend, 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 buy, 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 consume, consume, consume. And so we should probably delete that one. I just was struck by that disposition. I mean, it's a different culture, and we should be condemned by the latter.
I remember the wonderful conversations. I took a group of young people to Tanzania back in 1995, group, and we worked for 3 or 4 weeks. We built fish ponds. We dug an irrigation canal, and we also dug a foundation for a kindergarten for our church school. But in the evening, we would just talk with them, and we were working alongside other youth. These were college age and upper high school level. And I remember one evening discussing burial practices and funeral practices, and also conversations about how we take care of older people in our society. And the Tanzanian youth thought it was just totally barbaric what we did with people when they died. The thought that you wouldn't, as a family, be able to take care of those people and bury, sending them to a mortuary for someone else to touch, and you know, they thought that this was, you know, it was that same kind of a thing, a wholly different way. We do things in a way that assumes that this is, and the same thing with the kind of isolated family structure we have in this country, where everybody are these nuclear families. There, I mean, it was sort of like here at Olin Village, you didn't worry about your kid going out and running around. There was always another adult or other children to take care of them. I mean, this sense of responsibility for family is what's getting Africa through this incredible HIV crisis. Without, you know, we would be building orphanages by the, you know, we'd be collecting money for orphanages. That's how we do things here. They have to do some of that too, because they can't keep up with it. But some of these are cultural differences and cultural values, and I think that it's difficult when they come in. I should give you a chance to talk. You're here. You're almost leaving. What, you've heard some of this discussion. What do you think about what's been said about these? Do you have anything to respond to what you've heard, Krista?
I don't know.
I'm not asking for a long sermon here. I just thought there was. I just want you to feel free to respond to anything that's been said, because we're talking about some cultural differences.
Several cultural differences. Anyway, I'm not been here for so long, but when I arrived here, I went to Isapa, so I was received by one lady who is a widow. So she's staying alone. She has 2 sons who are just far away. And so I asked her, why are you just staying alone? She said, it's something. I don't know. Go to my neighbor and ask anything, whatever. This is the way we live here. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was strange to me, because in my country, it's just a social life. Whether I have my own house, I'm living there, but my neighbor would come and would like to know how I'm going on. almost every day. And if I don't have anything, maybe I'm lacking something, I'll go up and request it from my neighbor and they'll give me. And for the people who are old, like my mother, she's 85. So because we are living now in town, and she has nobody to take care of, and I cannot send my children, you know, the grandchildren to the village before they're in school. So I bring her to my place where I'm living so that I can take care of her. We don't have these homes for all, but we live with them and take care of them. And of course, they feel so, they are so happy because the grandchildren are there. When they come back from school, they play with them and whatever. So at least it gives them comfort, some sort of that. Something which is different here.
Thank you for sharing that. There was a hand back here.
I think I'm struggling here a little bit because of the sufficiency.
Yes.
We're all made so differently, and some people have a God-given gift that they multiply, you know, the 10-talent idea. And others, they just look at it and it disappears. I mean, it's the weird life of being a human being. And some people that have an overabundance, and I know we've had the pleasure of meeting some of these people that have this wonderful gift, and they share it and help with humanity. Others are all self-centered. And I mean, it's a human nature problem, but I would hate to think I'm hearing almost a communist type of thinking where everybody's, I realize that, you know, everybody's living on the same, what's yours is mine, mine is yours, and this type of thing. I don't think I'll ever work either. But we are different, and of the sufficiency gift of overabundance by some people are being used very well, others blow it badly. But I hear these people that have been successful almost get upset, thinking, am I being condemned for, I mean, they just got this knack, you know, and it's a hard message that we're putting out. It doesn't mean everybody's doing it right. I don't mean to say that at all. But we need to give credit to those that have been given that gift and are, sharing and looking, how can I help this to be a better place than when I came?
What I was talking about, Arthur Simon, you know who Arthur Simon is, the person who founded Bread for the World? You've heard of Bread for the World. Well, he's a Missouri Lutheran pastor who started that organization. And a number of years ago he wrote a book, but he within the last month or so has come up with a book called How Much is Enough, I think. I brought it here and I've lost it, so it's around here someplace. I got about halfway through it. I guess
check
I'll have
the piano.
What?
I think I saw it on top of the piano in the dining hall.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. But I would just recommend that book because it deals with that aspect of it, because he's talking about, you know, personal wealth and resources, and I think he has some good answers, and I won't go into that here.
Who is the author again, Jude?
Arthur Simon, S-I-M-O-N, Arthur Simon. But he talks about that in terms of his own. He's I consider him a real wise man, partly because he's a lot older than I am, and not that everybody's older than I am is wise, but he's just a very gracious and kind person, and is just a tremendous perspective. But it's a small, thin little paperback. I think you could probably, if you could contact Bread for the World and get it. But if you just type in Arthur Simon in an Amazon.com, you could come up with that book. It's a 2003 publication.
What's the title of that book?
What?
The title of it?
I think it's called How Much is Enough?
How Much is Enough?
Yeah. Yes?
I think, as Americans, we've been so incredibly blessed
We are like the rich man that it's hard to go through the needle. It's hard to say, I'm willing to give up a little bit of my standard of living. And that's, I mean...
I think that's hard individually because we always think that we'll maybe need it in the future. There's a lot of conflict. We're sort of shifting gears here, but it's okay. It's not okay because it's time to quit. But I think that a lot of Christians in this country are struggling with lifestyle and choices that they make. We are an incredibly wealthy country, and because we ourselves are so concerned about our own security, it's even more difficult to think that our country as a country is going to be willing to share its wealth if we aren't willing to do that at a personal level. So that's a, I don't know, that's a, but there are people who are doing wonderful things. I lived for 3 years in Liberia as a Peace Corps volunteer back in 1968, 69, and 70. Out of that experience, I looked at the difference between the nuclear family and the extended family. When I came back here, we had met another couple. They were a Jewish couple, volunteers for the Catholic mission. We decided when we got to know them very well, and we lived side by side with, you know, people who get to know them very well. When we came back here, we decided, irregardless of where the jobs were, we were going to live together in a house. We bought a house together. We lived there 4 years until my job ended, and I had to leave the community and get another job. But we did it because we wanted more adults to be involved in our children's life. What it meant for us, it meant that, first of all, our wives could stay home and take care of the children. They didn't have to go to work. We split the cost, our mortgage payment, insurance, and taxes totaled $97.50 a month, and we split that in half. It meant that we didn't have to be on a work treadmill. We shared a car. And it was a very enriching thing. Our lives, in my opinion, were much richer than the people around us who were having to go out, get two jobs, make the house payments, make the car payments, you know, all that kind of stuff. It didn't last. It wasn't anything that we pursued. It was, you know, we were glad to go our separate ways and do our other things. But, you know, for that time in our life, it was a decision we made that was really, our parents couldn't understand what we were doing because we had a job. We didn't have to live. You know, it's poor people who have to double up and live in houses together, right? It was a real countercultural thing. I've never regretted it. Our children are like brothers and sisters today, and our lives were richer as a result. So and what was good about it, it kept me honest in the housework. You know, with Vivian, I would just find excuses. You know, I'd get vacuumed today, or it's not my turn to do the dishes. But when you live with other people, they hold you accountable for your behavior, just like they do here. So anyway, I've gone way past the hour. Thank you for coming, and